you won't maybe just have one big break, but you'll have many tiny little breaks that you may not even notice that one day add up to a really fulfilling and beautiful career.
Sarah States is an actor, singer, and writer. She has performed as an actor everywhere from regional theater to readings and workshops of new work to the esteemed playwrights Horizons in New York City, and her own work, Mommy Milk Cafe, just premiered as part of the Players Theater Short Play Festival last month. She is an incredibly thoughtful and talented actor who we were lucky enough to have play our protagonist, Olivia, in our short film screen test. And she's with us today on the podcast. Welcome to The Break Breakdown, Sarah.
Thank you for having me. That was such a beautiful intro.
Oh my gosh. Well, it's all true. So before we start, I feel like anyone I'm talking to right now in this crazy time of the coronavirus, I just like really want to check in with. So how are you? Are you sleeping? Are you eating enough? You know, how are you doing?
Yeah, that's such a loaded question. I think it changes every day. And I feel like there's been various stages of quarantine. I escaped the city pretty early on in April, and I'm now in Buffalo, New York, where things are much different here. In Western New York, there really wasn't a big COVID wave. So I think the general feels a lot safer. But I think that I've been spending a lot of time just focusing on reading, catching up on the TV shows I want to catch up on, yeah. Exercising, not too much creating, really just taking it day by day and meeting myself where I'm at every day.
That sounds great. That actually sounds like a really good prescription for living normally that we don't allow ourselves to do.
I totally agree.
Yeah. So I wanted to start off our little interview telling you about your self-tape for screen test. So when we were trying to cast this back in January of 2020, when we were completely different human beings living in a different world, mm-hmm. We had submissions for self-tapes, basically just based friends of friends recommending friends and all that. So we had seen some really, really wonderful actors for the part, and we got your self-tape in, and I loaded it up on the screen, and Craig, my husband, was sitting right by me and watching kind of over my shoulder. And literally after the first line, both of us looked at each other and we were like, that's Olivia. If we can get her, that's our film. So it was just like, it was just so great. And like, just one of those moments where, I don't know, it's just like when you know. I think from my acting background, I always thought that there were like really methodical reasons and that, you know, people were chosen, and there are those reasons in casting, but it was a real big kind of like blaring green light, I want to say, when you came on the screen, and there was just something really instinctual and intuitive about your performance. And I guess I want to know what your relationship is with your instincts and your intuition, and maybe that has to do with acting, maybe it doesn't, but I'd love to know just your relationship with those things.
Absolutely. I'd say that history says that I'm a very I follow my instincts, and that is maybe sometimes to a fault. Maybe that's in acting too, but definitely in my personal life, in my real life, I've definitely, when I have a strong reaction or a strong gut feeling, I guess is what a lot of people describe an instinct or as, I take it and I follow it. I like to ask people for advice, and my parents, my partner, they would say that I'm constantly asking them for their opinions and what they think I should do. But at the end of the day, they almost feel a little bit frustrated with me because their attitude is, why do you even ask? Because you already know deep down what you're going to be doing. And it frustrates them because, you know, they may feel very strongly one way, but I, you know, I can't take their logic. And I just really, when I have that feeling, I go for it. And sometimes that starts off really good. And, but then later I'll run into problems which may have been avoided had I done some, you know, serious consideration from the get-go. But generally I find that a gut feeling is one that should be seriously considered, because it, I think it's your body telling you the answer.
Right.
For yourself. And I think that you should more often than not take that. Not to say that it hasn't gotten me into trouble, but you know, I think for the most part, most of your gut feeling is what's best for you.
Right. Well, and not to say that doing a kind of calculated decision couldn't get you into trouble too. You know, I've had plenty of those as well.
Yeah, for sure.
That kind of brings me to the question that, you know, you're kind of leaning into already, which is, how much of acting for you is preparing for the role, and how much of it is letting go?
I love this question because I think I've thought a lot about this during this time at home. I think now that we're in this time of self-taping as actors, which takes a lot of preparation, in my opinion. I think it takes a lot of learning new materials by yourself on your own with not a lot of feedback, and just sort of doing this extra prep work in order to, you know, put yourself in front of casting in a way that you maybe you're not used to. And I think that my takeaway is, do the prep in order to let go. I think something that someone told me, I can't remember who it was, but we were talking about how there's a lot of freedom in structure. So you set the groundwork and you prepare really hard so that in the moment when it comes down to it, you can forget about all of it and let go. And I think that's something that I've really wanted to work on during this time, because you can prep endlessly, but in the moment, everything can change. I don't know. I mean, I don't really have a lot of formal acting training, so I don't really know. But I think that finding the freedom can only happen if you have the structure.
Yeah. Okay. So like eight things I want to pick up on in what you said. First of all, yes, totally agree. Prepare and that, and then let go, which is something that I think when I was acting, like when the main thing that I was doing was acting, that was very difficult for me to let go of the plan, because I'm a control freak, which is not, by the way, I don't think is a good thing, and something that I've tried to kind of let go as I've gotten older. And then I think that's really wise insofar as when the moment happens, and it's not the preparation moment. It is the new moment. And also, you didn't have a lot of formal acting training?
No. So when I moved to the city, I acted when I was a kid in my high school productions or local Buffalo theaters. But when I moved to the city, I went to AMDA, the American Musical and Dramatic Academy, for a year, but I dropped out in order to pursue a new career. And I didn't return to acting until about a year and a half, 2 years ago. So, of course, I've tried to amp up my training since returning to acting, but I definitely don't come from the traditional background that a lot of my colleagues and peers do.
Okay, this is fascinating to me because I had no idea, and I scoured your website. And this is the thing too about shooting on a 12-hour day. Like, had we been on set for 3 months together, I totally would have known all of this material about you. But can you, if you feel comfortable just sharing, like, can you just talk a little bit about why you left, what you did, and then also I'm super interested in why you came back?
Sure. I feel like I've had many lives in New York. So I've been in New York for only, I think it's been 10 or 11 years. And of course, I wanted to pursue musical theater straight out of high school. But when I arrived in New York, although I made a lot of friends in my program, I felt very conflicted. I felt a lot of anxiety. being a small fish in this huge pond. You know, there wasn't a lot of diversity in the program that I was in, at least in my class. And I think all of these different factors really led to an unhealthy mental state. And so I decided literally instinctual just to leave one day. And I called my parents and I said, hey, I'm about to drop out of my program. And of course that they were very upset, but I was also very upset. Right. And I felt like it was in my best interest to leave immediately. So I went to, you know, the student center, and that day I dropped out and I never went back to class again. And looking back, this is one of those moments where had I thought it out a little bit more, you know, maybe I would have finished the program. I only had like less than a year left. Right. Maybe I would have finished. But then again, maybe I'd be in a totally different place right now. And I'm very happy with where I am right now. But I was given an opportunity to work for a men's fashion startup. We were doing custom suiting, and there was only three of us working there. And I was only 18 or 19. And I ended up taking on a lot of responsibility there. And too much responsibility. I left there after a year and a half of many, many 24-hour work days, and I wish them the best. but after that, I decided to go to Baruch College, where I studied arts administration, but visual arts administration. So I decided to work in art galleries, which I did for 2 years, and really, really enjoyed that. But it was through a conversation with my boss at the art gallery. She started her art gallery when she was in her early 20s, and we were having a conversation one day, and she said, you know, if you're not happy here, you really should pursue, you know, your artistic career immediately. Like, leave here, go and do it now. Mm. And ultimately that's what urged me to quit, and I quit 2 days later. And that was that. And so, and then I decided to embark on this journey as a full-time artist. And yeah, that's kind of led me to today.
That is, I have chills all over my body just thinking about how quickly you went from epiphany to action in mm-hmm. both of those instances, in leaving AMDA and then in coming back to your, you know, your art form, because I think a lot of us get stuck between epiphany and action, or we don't even allow ourselves to fully embrace that epiphany, or that epiphany is almost like a bit too big of a word, just like telling ourselves the truth. You know what I mean? Like allowing ourselves to tell ourselves the truth, because we can say anything out to the world, but when you're alone in your own thoughts, it's, you know, when you're BSing yourself, you know?
Right. I love that. I think a lot of the times when I'm posing a question out to the world, I already know the answer myself.
Yes. 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 We could unpack that, like, as so many structures in our world don't actually want us to follow the instinct or live in a liminal space of a gray area. And what an amazing relationship, whether it was like a deep long-term one or a superficial kind of in the moment one, but with your boss at the art gallery, for her to be so generous as to say, you need to do this now. And I feel as someone in my 30s that my 20s were all about like doing what I thought I was supposed to do. And that it's almost, it's taken me almost halfway through my 30s to be like, listen, kid, just do what you want to do unapologetically and let go of what the results are. Just do the thing and let the results just be what they are. Did you feel any of that when you jumped back into your career? Did you jump back in with a goal? Did you know what the moves were that you wanted to make?
I had started to pick up a couple very small acting jobs while still at the gallery. And I knew that I wanted to do theater right off the bat. And but I guess no. I guess the short answer is no. I had no idea, and I'm not so much a goal setter. So,
great.
I'm just I've never been the person that writes the goals down and then tries to achieve them by a certain time or stick to them. I'm more of a person that just likes to see where life takes me. And I think I have issues myself. I feel like sometimes I read that as a lack of ambition, but I also feel like it's allowed me to experience things that I never would have ever had the opportunity to experience had I been so set on achieving one thing after another. Mm-hmm. And I think goal setting can be not dangerous, but sometimes I think goal setting hurts you, because once you get to that point, you're either setting a new goal right away ahead of that, or you're like, okay, that's done. I achieved that, you know. And I don't think life is about like, okay, now what? Like, I think it's more like, I think you experience more things if you open up the realm of possibilities and are not so set on the next thing.
Right.
I don't know. I feel like that's a little bit of thrashing, but
no,
I've just never been a good at goal setter. So no, like when I was returning to this career in the arts, I ultimately had no idea what I was doing and no idea where I wanted to be in a year or beyond maybe making a livable wage.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, I think that's beautiful. And I think that's a beautiful message to share with people, particularly because we're in this time of kind of dismantling the white supremacist, patriarchal, capitalist way of thinking, which is always about productivity and how productive we can be for the economy. And while you have to have a living wage and put food in your belly and a roof over you, there's so much more to life than goal setting. And I think that it's really powerful for me to be looking at you and the kind of actor you are and where you are in your career and knowing that you got there by staying open, and that is a strategy as much as setting your 10-year goal is a strategy, which, by the way, no 10-year goal I ever set was what I wanted 10 years later. That's beautiful. Okay. So I would love for you, I know it's been a minute. We're recording in August. We filmed this, screen test short film in February.
Wow. Right before we shut down.
Oh my gosh. Like probably should have been shut down then, but we weren't. Can you talk a little bit, if you remember, Olivia, can you talk a little bit about your character, Olivia, in Screen Test?
Sure. So Olivia, like the other characters in Screen Test, is a fitness trainer. She is probably the most grounded character. She's surrounded by these other fitness trainers that have larger than life personalities. And I think that this can be somewhat overwhelming to her character. She's confident, but she also has certain insecurities. And I think that through it all, she tries to keep a level head. Like myself, I think she's really connected with her own intuition. And I think that she strives to be a change maker despite everything that's going on around her. So yeah, I think she brings like a maturity and authenticity to the film amidst a lot of fun and chaos.
Yeah. Chaos is a great word for that. And I love you bring up chaos, because if you look at the plot, not like things don't really happen, but people's inner lives happen a lot and they spill out and they are chaotic. I would love to know how you prepared for this role. So we probably cast it in middle to late January. We filmed middle to end of February and we were on set for one day. So how did you prepare for something like that?
Well, so a lot of the role is or maybe all, most of it is monologuing. So for me, this just technically requires like different prep as far as acting goes. I felt like this role was very personal, the way it's written, and also personal to myself and my character. So I really wanted to just dissect every line and really find those moments that resonated with me deeply. And I think that when I was preparing my self-tape audition for this, because I was alone and because it was monologuing and, you know, I set up the camera myself, there was no one else in the room. It was just me in my quarantine. I felt like that really added something to this role because not in my quarantine, sorry, this is before, but I was, Oh, I was alone in Buffalo, New York, in my apartment alone. That's why it felt like quarantine. And it was like very personal to be, you know, not in dialogue with a reader. Like it was just very me behind the camera. And I think like that was really, it made me feel really connected in a way that sometimes I'm not when I'm doing a self-tape. But, and because Olivia is a character that I really identify with, you know, I think you're able to bring a level of authenticity that's just truly yourself. And, you know, it wasn't about putting on a character or stepping into a character's shoes. It was almost like just, it was almost like what Olivia is doing in the film, like a confessional in a way.
Right.
And I really, so often as actors, you know, you put on, you step into someone else's shoes or you're telling someone else's story. Whereas Olivia, it's more like telling my own story in a way. I'm not a fitness trainer, but I do have the same insecurities that she does. And I maybe have similar dreams as she does, and feelings. And so for me, it was just a very personal exploration and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. Say like Olivia was like me. I just like want to give you a hug and a high five because someone asked me on set, you know, of all these characters, I think it was Lily, our amazing sound person. I think she said of all these characters, which one is the one most like you? And I was like, well, Olivia, definitely Olivia. Mm-hmm. With like moments of Debbie of being like,
yeah,
screw all of you. but yeah, I think that was what I loved about your performance too, is that there were these four other characters that were much more performative in I'm not even talking about the actor's performance, just the characters themselves written are
right.
Performative. And your portrayal of Olivia and Olivia the character are both kind of the balance to that. And I don't know if she wins out by the end. You know what I mean? That's kind of up to the watcher, right. I guess, to find out if she like anchors it down, like if she lands, if what she wants actually comes through, or if she kind of gets washed away by it. But that's also what I loved about your performance too. It was so open, and we were, you know, watching the edits back and you know, choosing the different shots and all of that and the different takes. It's like you really allowed the moment to be exactly what it was without putting a performance on top of it or putting a editorial without editorializing it. And I think for these roles that are very like stripped down and pared down, that's really difficult to do because you're trying to like act. You know what I mean? Like, and I think when we get in our heads about acting and showing acting, like we can get like really off the rails. And you were so flawless in it. It was such a beautiful portrayal.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
That's really, it's really generous.
I mean, look, I'm just telling the truth. quick sidebar. So I saw on your Insta stories the other day, because obviously I stalk everyone in the cast. I'm just like, oh, I want to be best friends with everyone. that you love watching The Office and your husband doesn't like that? He doesn't like The Office?
Yeah. So The Office is something that I watch before I go to bed.
Yes.
When I'm eating lunch and I'm taking a break from doing work, mm-hmm. or when I'm really hungover, I'll just sit on the couch all day and watch The Office. So I'm about six. I think I've watched it about six times through all the seasons.
Yep.
On my seventh time, and I'm currently on season six. And every time he hears the music, he has this like physical reaction to it where he's just repulsed by it. And, or he'll start, I think the Insta story that you're referring to, he was yelling at me every time he hears it. He'll just go, no, no, no. he cannot stand it. I don't know what it is about the show. I think that, well, for one thing, and he's not a very like, you know, PC guy. Like I don't like he, you know, we watch, he's not like, he doesn't dislike slightly offensive humor, right. But I think he has a problem with, he doesn't understand how the Office humor can fly these days. He's like, you know, some of it is very risky in today's climate. Like you, like right. Would the show air today, the way it's written?
Right.
I don't know. Like definitely certain episodes, I don't think, you know, you wouldn't want to put that out into the world today.
Right.
And I think he just can't get over that factor. So it's not really funny to him. It's just kind of like overly stupid.
Yeah.
But, I love it and I still watch it. And, of course I do take offense to some of the things that are said, and I'm definitely sensitive to the fact that, you know, it was written at a time when certain jokes were, you know, I don't know. I don't know if it was this, you know, it's kind of like watching Friends today too.
Right.
Certain things you're just like, that is so cringeworthy, or Sex in the City. Right. And I'm like, oh, how God, could yeah. they even get away with doing this? Like right. it's so wrong.
Right.
We have to remember that, like, you know, as a society, we've just evolved past that and we've, you know, grown and learned. And I think, like, you know, you have to take these, not saying that it's right or wrong, but you have to just like, the Office humor is, you either love it or you don't. And I love it.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny because during this whole quarantine, my husband and I have watched through it two or three times. Like the first time we watched through it, I was like, I don't care. After Michael leaves, let's just start over again. I don't even need to see the end of the whole series.
That's what my dad just said. He's like, yeah. How can you even watch it after Michael leaves?
Yeah. I mean, look, the actors do a great job. It's just like, I don't know. It's just Steve Carell is Steve Carell. And I agree, Craig and I have definitely had those conversations of like, ooh, that joke isn't funny. But it's interesting because I think The Office, more than Sex in the City and Friends, is self-aware of its like right. racism and sexism. And, you know, so like in some ways it's like, well, it's being self-aware and it's showing how terrible that is, you know, whatever they are that's saying. But then there are some some points where you're just like, that's not funny anymore. But the show itself does feel like we've been trying to watch it to counterbalance the news and like the darker things that we watch. Mm-hmm. We're like, it feels like a warm blanket. It feels like a cup of tea sometimes, you know, like it's just feel good. And I think it obviously had a lot of influence on how I wrote Screen Test and kind of how we shot it and envisioned it. There are a lot of takes that Alexa, our DP, did that we were, you know, referencing certain things in The Office. So I'm excited for you to see it. And maybe your husband will like Screen Test more than The Office.
Absolutely. And that's so true. Like the way that The Office is filmed, I could definitely see that in Screen Test for sure.
Yeah.
I haven't seen Screen Test, but I can just picture it now. I can't wait.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I can't wait to share with you guys. In looking at the things that you've done, and the fact that you've written your own work, Mommy Milk Cafe, it seems like you work on a lot of new pieces. And so I wanted to know if, A, like you would agree that that's accurate. And then if it is, what has been what is being part of new works taught you both about the artistic side and the business side of this industry?
Yeah, that's completely accurate. But it's a combination of a couple of things. First of all, I haven't been on many, you know, long running theater contracts the past couple of years. So it definitely keeps me busy to work on more new works. And I think like just the contacts that I've been able to network with and develop relationships with so far in the past couple of years have led to many opportunities in sort of like the new works world. I'm a good sight reader, so that definitely helps as well, mm-hmm. as far as musical theater new works go. So in combination with that, and also the fact that I really love working on new work, and for me, I was not the typical theater kid mm-hmm. growing up, and even into my short experience in musical theater school and college, I always felt like the odd person out, I guess, because I didn't eat, sleep, breathe musical theater for sure.
Right.
That just wasn't me. And did I love to sing certain musical theater songs? Did I love certain characters? Sure. But like, was I, you know, fully immersed in the world? Did I have the posters? Did I memorize, you know, the score? Like, no, that just wasn't me.
Right.
And I think that, you know, a lot of that was because in the traditional musical theater world, in the material that I was presented up through that time, oftentimes I did not see myself in the material because, you know, growing up in school, you do like shows like, what did we do? Guys and Dolls or Thoroughly Modern Millie or Cinderella. And for me at that time, I wasn't chosen for those roles other than not in big roles at least. And I never saw myself in them either. And I guess I'm talking about representation and
sure.
I can remember watching the Cinderella, the Whoopi Goldberg, Brandy, and I can't remember his name, but the Asian prince version. And
yeah.
I clung to that so hard, Courtney. Like, I have seen that film so many times and it was so unreal to me. I was almost like, how dare these people make this beautiful film? Like, I could not even believe that the cast was, like, I just could not believe that the prince was Asian. Like, that drove
right.
me absolutely crazy because I just couldn't believe it. And because that was like the only, literally the only thing that I had, I think that instead of being like a beacon of light, it was almost more like they gave us the one, us meaning, I don't know, people of color, I guess, this one film, you know? And I almost felt like
right.
a knock. Like I was like, I mean, I loved it and I clung to it, but I was also like, you know, if this is all that we get, like it's going to be very bleak for me. And so I think like because of the traditional musical theater world was always cast a certain way, I feel like being a part of new works for me is so much more interesting because today these new works they encourage sort of like, you know, I struggle with the word diverse, but I guess that's what it is, like diverse casting. And, you know, they're writing stories that haven't been told and they're writing from this new lens, which I find so refreshing. And finally, I'm starting to see myself be a part of the picture. And that's so much more interesting to me than, you know, trying to be the one, or, you know, one of three people of color or Asian American women in, you know, an already written musical, or to be in Miss Saigon or The King and I. Like I would so much
right.
rather be a part of, you know, these new stories that so desperately need to be told. And also in my own writing, I suppose, I would consider myself a writer. Does that mean that I make money off of my writing? No, absolutely not. Am I even published? No, but I still consider myself a writer. Like I'm, you know, that's something that I creatively do on, not necessarily a daily basis, but a weekly basis. I, you know, would like to see my plays staged one day. And I think like what is so intriguing to me about writing new works is the fact that I want to tell stories that haven't yet been told. And like, I think that is so special, especially since I've never seen my personal story told on a stage. Like, I can't wait till the day that I do. And I hope that, you know, it inspires, you know, young artists who have a similar background to me where they feel like there's no spot for them in the theater. I hope it encourages them to pursue a career in the arts.
Yeah, I mean,
that was a really wordy, long answer, and I apologize.
Oh no,
I feel like I sort of like blacked out, like I had no idea.
No, it was so. I'm so there with you, and it's funny. It's like at the beginning of you talking about feeling like you didn't have a place in theater, and like you weren't the typical musical theater kid, and you loved things, but you felt on the outside. I had that feeling too. Now I'm white, so like there were plenty of roles for me, and there were plenty of spots for me, and I did see myself in things. So like I connected with you on there, and then it was really interesting for me to just listen to how vastly different our experiences were, even though, you know, maybe we felt inklings of the same thing, but then to see that movie and it kind of be like, here's your token movie, guys, we're not racist, you know, or like whatever that feeling was to see this one thing. It also is just making me think like, right, like, cause even if you cast diversity, you're to tell a white story, you know, or a story that was told within a white lens about white folks at the time. It's like there's definitely merit to, I think, looking back at old stories and reframing them now and having a completely different picture of what those stories mean. But I agree with you in that I've always been more interested in new work, in new plays on Broadway, not revivals, in, you know, in the independent world, in both theater and film and books and art, you know, the independent voice, I think, is where we find the most genius. And I, you know, you're teaching me a lot about perspective. And I think it's really important for people to think about too, in the kind of content we ingest. Are we ingesting things that are super, I mean, I just talked about being like, oh, I watched The Office, but like, are we ingesting, are we consuming, you know, new stories? And I think that's on both ends of creation and consumption. That's a place where we want to go. And probably our kids are already going to be there and we're going to catch up to them, you know? Mm-hmm. I love that. So going back a little bit to your kind of work as an actor, and I'm framing it as an actor, but let's just actually make it as an actor and a writer and just talk about the whole human being here. what did you misunderstand about these art forms when you started out that you feel like you understand better now?
When I think about this, I just think about what I learned in school, in my short time at school, because I think that it was extremely misguided. And I think that I carried that with me. Well, I think ultimately it led to me wanting to leave the industry. But I think that I better understand now that just in general, being an artist, it's almost like I was a vegetarian for a lot of my life growing up, and, you know, I carried that title with pride. But, you know, as I grew older, every once in a while I would cheat and have like a chicken wing when I was back in Buffalo or something like that. And people would point to you and be like, oh, you're not really a vegetarian. You just did that. And I think that's kind of how I feel about being an artist. Like, I think I misunderstood what it meant to be an artist. And now I know what it really means. And to be an artist is not necessarily just this, you know, persona that you have to uphold, or it's really a personal journey. And you can be an artist, a full-time artist, a career artist, and not be successful, and not be you could be an artist, full-time career artist, and also have a thrival or survival job. You can be a full-time artist and take a break for 10 years and go do something else or go back to school. I think that's what I misunderstood. Like, I think I thought that, you know, I put these artists on a pedestal, and you know, they seem to be so successful and making good money, and you know, only doing certain things. And I think like that is just not the case. And I know that because I see my peers and my colleagues and my friends who are for the most part all artists, and you know, we all have struggles, and we all, you know, are financially, some of us, you know, less stable than others. And I just think like, it's just being an artist is more of a way of life and a feeling, rather than like, you can't really put a title on it. And I think I misunderstood that until recently.
Yeah. That resonates with me so much. I completely amplify that, because I think that if I was going to answer that question, it'd be the same thing. Just the idea that when I started out, it was like, okay, well, I need to have 6 Broadway credits by this date to be able to do this, to do this, to do that. And it kind of goes back to what you're saying at the beginning about goal setting and staying open rather than like having a strict idea of how things need to happen. And I completely agree. Artistry is a way of life. Which kind of brings me to my last question, actually, really beautifully. So this podcast is called The Break Breakdown. And I've really been thinking, it's definitely about Screen Test and the short film that we made, and an introduction to people about that. But I also wanted to put it in context of things beyond just the short film that we made, and, you know, why we made this film. And this idea that I've been toying around with, which is, you know, it's so weird that we're trying to break into an industry when we actually want to break down the systems within the industry that are in place. Like, it's this dynamic that's, I don't know, just kind of like, okay, I want to be a part of that. But then once I'm there, I want to change all of it and make it operate differently. And this idea of also in that ethos and that spirit, thinking about what it means to get your big break. Usually people are saying like, oh, maybe she gave me my big break, or that opportunity gave me my big break. And I'm wondering about what it means to kind of take your big break. Say like, this is, you know, I don't want to say my seminal work, but like, this is my thesis right now. This is my work. This is the backbone of what I'm creating, and what I will create in the future, and what it means to kind of take your big break into your own hands. And there's this great letter written by Hunter S. Thompson from the 50s about finding purpose. And someone, a friend of his, writes to him and says, you know, like, how can I figure out what to do with my life? And he goes on this huge kind of diatribe going all over the place about, you know, we aren't our jobs, we are ourselves. And he says, as I said, to put our faith in tangible goals would seem to be at best unwise. So we do not strive to be firemen. We do not strive to be bankers, nor policemen, nor doctors. We strive to be ourselves. And so in context of that quote, I guess I want to know for you, Sarah, what does it mean for you to strive to be yourself?
Wow, there's so much to dissect there. I love what you said at first about instead of, you know, having a big break to take your big break, just changing that word completely changes the context of what we're saying. And I think that I do strive to be myself first. And I think it took me a lot of time to be okay with that. I think I mentioned it earlier on in the podcast that I've often struggled with feeling like I have a lack of ambition because I'm not a goal setter. And because I was never like, I want to be this and only this, and I will not be happy until I am this. That's just not been my journey. And I think because I've been many different things. I've been an actor, I've been a choral singer, I've been a startup, whatever that was, everything. I've been a gallery assistant. I've been an archivist. I've been many different things. And what if I had said, I will not be happy until I am this every single time? I never would have found any happiness in that. And I think that I do think it's so important to have a life outside of career as well. So if you become that focused on career, your outside decisions will all be influenced to point in that same direction. And I think that you ultimately, one misses out on so much if you live that way. And not to say that it's wrong to live that way, but it just hasn't been in my experience. And as far as big break goes, I don't know. That's kind of like waiting for something that, what does that even mean? I'm not even sure what that means. Does that mean like you book a huge Netflix show and then you'll make millions of dollars or you'll make millions of followers? I guess that's like a big break. But I don't know. To me, I think for me, it's just having work to do, enjoying that work, and being asked to do more work, even if that's not making a lot of money or, you know, giving me any fame. I consider that to be a success. And, I think that that may not be a big break, but somewhere someone along the line recognized that you are a hard worker, you have some sort of talent and, charisma or something. And so I think like maybe we don't just have one big break, but maybe if you just keep moving forward and doing what you love with integrity, then I think, you know, you won't maybe just have one big break, but you'll have many tiny little breaks that you may not even notice that one day add up to a really fulfilling and beautiful career.
Yeah, that's lovely.
That's what I hope, at least.
Yes, yes.
And maybe it's because I haven't had a big break, but maybe that's why I say these things. But I do feel that way.
Yeah. Well, and it also goes back to your idea of like, you can't just be like, what's next? Now what? You know, if you get that big break and you get that $1 million from Netflix or whatever, you're still going to be left with that same question if you're not finding joy all along the way without putting it into, a tangible goal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Last question. What gives you hope?
Wow. I struggle with this today just because I have no idea. Do any of us have any idea what the future looks like as far as 2 months from now, 6 months from now, or a year from now? Really, like, what do we know? I don't think we know anything. I don't think we know what our industry will look like, what our country will look like. I think that, yeah. So I think I struggle with that at this time. And especially with being artistic, I think it's been tough to be consistent in my creativity during this time, but I'm definitely inspired by watching other people create, while at home or while distanced from others. And they're creating things that I think never, ever would have come to light if not for quarantine or being in this sort of existing during COVID time. And I think, and also sort of like the climate that we're in with social justice and things like this, like, I think that the stories that are being told this year are so inspiring and so important. And that excites me, because after post-COVID, or when we do get back to the theater, we do get back to sets, I hope that it's these stories that we see. And I'm not sure what it looks like to sit in a theater yet, or like if that's even going to be possible in the next year or so. But I do think when it comes to that time, I really hope that the stories that we see are ones that originated during this time. Because I think what's being created now is going to be so important. And just, I think it's the art that the world needs right now.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more. That's a beautiful way to end. This has been so great talking with you. And I wish we could do it every day.
So much fun. I never get to talk about myself like this and my, you know, it's been really nice.
Well, look, open invitation whenever you want to come back on. If you have anything that you want to promote and talk about, I'd be happy to do it all again. So please let me know. Where can people find you online if they want to follow you and see what you're up to?
I have a very modest website, www.sarastates.me, where you can find my little news section, which I update about once a month.
Amazing. This was so great, Sarah. Thank you so much. And can't wait for you to see your work in Screen Test. It's really beautiful.
Thank you so much.
As always, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. It really helps get the word out about it. And share with a friend if you think someone could benefit from this episode. And thanks for being here. I really appreciate it. Talk to you soon.